This is Jane McGonigal, the author of Super Better and a big fan of the Psych Tech Podcast. You're listening to Psych Tech Podcast, where you will get the future of psychology and technology.
Welcome to Psych Tech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Josue Cardona, with Kelly Dunlap. What's up, Kelly?
Hi. Nothing's up. You asked me, and my mind just went blank. Like there's nothing up right now. I'm just chilling. I'm ready. I'm
okay,
psyched.
All right.
I'm psyched and teched.
You're psyched, teched?
Yes.
Okay. We'll trademark that. So I told you I wanted to talk about privacy and safety and tech. But I didn't tell you why.
No.
Let me tell you a little story.
Okay.
A family member of mine called me this week and told me that she went to a couples counseling session. Okay? Very private stuff. But she went to her EAP program, right? Her employee assistance program. For people who don't know what that is, right? Sometimes your employer provides counseling services as a benefit. So you don't have to use your own insurance and it's provided by the employer. Sometimes they're on site, you know, it depends where you're working. So this family member of mine had been there before to do individual counseling some years ago. So they go for couples counseling and her partner says something that causes the psychologist who they're working with to suddenly look into her file and start reading information from a previous session that had been individual.
Okay, so I feel like you and I both have this hesitation, but why don't you explain why we're both kind of at a loss for words at this moment?
Why this is so infuriating and why I couldn't care less why they were at couples counseling. I just gave her a list of things to report and call back for. Mm-hmm. Your sessions are private. There's confidentiality. And even though you may sign some sort of record, some release of records to family members in case of emergencies or high threat levels, this was something that was so casual that my family member was shocked. She didn't realize what was happening at the moment. And so imagine you're having a counseling session with your significant other, and all of a sudden, all of these things that you mentioned before in private, in confidentiality, suddenly come up because this particular location has a joint record system. So for every employee, they just have one file. And this person just casually did that.
I mean, just to be crystal clear, that is unethical and mm-hmm. That's against guidelines. Like that's against the rules. If you take mm-hmm. on an individual and then they want to do couples with you, you cannot bring what they said in the individual session into the couple session with you. That is unethical. That is a breach of confidentiality for this exact reason. And I mean, this is one of those like soft ones. Like, well, you know, shades of gray. Like, no, you don't do it. It's wrong.
What's worse?
Oh God, it gets worse.
Yeah, because it wasn't the same psychologist.
Oh my God.
They read the record from another psychologist in the middle of the session because they just had it all on hand.
So the psychologist is reading it out loud. Not even uh-huh. just like reference. Oh my.
Yeah, referencing specifically a diagnosis. Yeah. No. Like, infuriating.
I'm speechless. Like that is such a
oh yeah
such a breach.
Yeah. So this has been on my mind, right? And it pissed me off earlier this week. And then I came across an article on Wired, which said the title was "Tech Can Do More to Help Survivors of Abuse." Here's where to start. Now I read that article and then I started connecting the two ideas. Not that this family member was going through an abusive relationship. I'm not sure. But that vulnerability in terms of privacy and information is something that has been on my mind. And I thought that this article was a good starting point, something cool to something interesting to look into and discuss. Because if that story that I just told you, right, that's something that was just done so casually, and you know things like that are going on all the time. But just, again, that feeling of vulnerability and not being blindsided with information that you assumed was private and how it can be used against you, it's just infuriating. Again, I mean, that's I'm pissed. I'm still pissed. Yeah. And, you know, people don't know the ethical codes for different mental health professionals or let alone a grievance process, right? I mean, all these types of things, we're misinformed or we just don't think about that at first. You know, we assume it's confidential. Nothing else is, you know, it's not going to leave this room and we leave it at that. But, oh, it's just, whew. Okay. Well, and then so getting back to the tech part, this particular article, it was interesting because Google is working with a group called the Community Overcoming Relationship Abuse. And then so Quora is saying that they work with abuse survivors and that is their specialty, but they don't know the technology, right? Everybody has technology is a huge part of everybody's life. They don't know how to leverage that adequately for this group of people, and Google started working with them because that's a group that they don't really keep in mind, right? It's not something that they designed for, essentially. But it's out there. So there's a few things that I wanted to discuss about that, just so we can avoid this kind of, you know, it's really sad, and it doesn't have to be just in the sense of abuse. It can be in I think that's an interesting frame, right, to put it in, because the article goes into a report or a study that they're doing where they're kind of dividing this different stages of a relationship that is where someone is a victim of abuse. They divided it into what they called physical control, escape, and life apart, and how in each of those stages, technology can play a very, very different role. And some of it is basic stuff, such as keeping your passwords, you know, away from your significant other. If you're sharing accounts, how that can be different, or location-based things. Like, I have a whole list of things that I want us to go over. But I just wanted to get your thoughts on the article and kind of this topic.
So I actually have two stories, and one is really serious, and one is kind of funny. So I'll start out with the serious one. I don't have the permission of the person to talk about this issue because I didn't know that this was going to be part of it. But so I'll just talk in generalities. Basically, somebody very close to me was in a very unhealthy relationship. Not physical abuse, but definitely a psychological and emotional abuse, in my opinion. And, you know, talking about this first stage of control, this person used to post to Facebook all the time and share and text and was very active on social media. And when she got into the relationship with this person, you know, not only did they physically move away from where they used to be, separating her from her friends and her family, she stopped posting to Facebook. She stopped returning texts, and her life became very isolated and locked down because of the control that this other person involved was exhibiting over her. That part of this article really hit home for me on a very personal level about how it's important for these tools to be able to help people in those kind of situations get out, especially if the other person, the abuser, has access to the passwords or things like that. On a lighter note, I have an app on my phone called Find Friends, and I use it to track my husband, which is, of course, with his consent, because you can't track somebody unless they accept the invitation to use that app with you. But it's really, in that case, it's really useful because then I can see, you know, when he's leaving work, where he's at, if I want to. Sometimes it's so I can start dinner. Sometimes it's so I can maintain my sanity, knowing how long until daddy's home so I can hand off the kid because, you know, I need to have the light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. But yeah, that could just as easily be used for nefarious purposes of tracking where people are, when they were there. And I mean, it's already something that legally happens, you know, using like triangulation of cell phone towers, which are not nearly as accurate. But the idea of using tech to track you, I think, is something that we're really going to wrestle with going forward in the future.
we both listened to a podcast recently from Recode that talked about ethical implications of technology changes, how one simple change can essentially affect, you know, a billion people was the phrase that they kept bringing up. And they discussed this idea that, well, it's there and it's up to people to use it or not. But then when you come into a frame like this, where you're talking about, well, people are in a very vulnerable position. How do you deal with that, right? I mean, this is a good start. You need to address it head on, because all that information is there. Again, and it does go beyond just being in an abusive relationship. It does come just – it's a general privacy and safety concerns. I've been thinking about different ways that that can be used this week, and it is not – it is two-sided, right? It isn't just how you can use it to protect yourself. Unfortunately, other people can use it against you, and how to be aware of both ends of that. Find My Friends is a good example of the type of account that maybe you set that up when you got your first iPhone 6 years ago and you forgot that you that it's on and that you gave your significant other or anybody that you're dating all of a sudden, or that they took your phone and activated it somehow. And in a moment like a, you know, an abusive relationship, or that moment where you need to get out, or you need to escape, you don't remember that that's on.
Yeah, it's kind of like being bugged, unbeknownst to you, that. And even beyond that, I mean, there's so many different ways to track people with the ability to find my phone and find friends and being able to look at IP addresses. And there's just so many ways that we leave digital footprints that I don't think we even process. And it reminds me of the last episode of Black Mirror, where they were able to follow all these digital breadcrumbs, you know, the geotagging in photos to figure out where the person was. And I feel that it's a privilege and something I take for granted that I don't have to think about it. But I can definitely appreciate and understand where those who have to be very, very aware of their social media or technological footprint.
Oh, man. Geolocations and photos. I didn't even remember that. That, you know, when you take a photo, there's all this metadata. It actually says you can go into a photo and see what photo, what device was used to take the photo. If it's a DSLR, I believe you can even see the lens that was used, and all sorts of different details, information that you would want if you're a photography buff. But also there's geolocation. Now, like you said, we totally take that for granted, but it used to be that for a DSLR, you would buy a GPS adapter, or I think you still can, just to get that geolocation. But with your phone, I believe that's done automatically. Something that we don't think about. So if you were trying to stay not hidden, but just, you know, have a little more privacy, and you're posting photos that have that metadata in it and you're not aware, you're essentially giving people access to your location. And, you know, a few years ago, my Netflix account was hacked somehow. And someone, like my recently watched was looking all weird. And I was like, wait a minute. So, and I didn't know this at the time, but Netflix had, and this is when I discovered it, Netflix has a very detailed account of how your account is being used. So you can see what country it was being logged in from and what time and all that sort of stuff. And it was somewhere in Europe. And I was like, well, that's definitely not me. So it gave you this option to it was like to log out from all other devices except the one that you're in right now. And a lot of services have that type of thing. But I didn't even think of it, or I didn't even think to check it until the breach of information had already happened. And those are one of those things that are available. And how do you know? Like, when that isn't part of the – there's so many things that these services can do. It's not in the tutorial, right? Facebook doesn't – Facebook especially. I mean, Facebook, where we're posting so much of our lives and has all these confusing privacy settings that are – you know, have changed so much over the years – it would – I mean, you'd need like a half hour, hour long course just right to give you an overview of all of different settings.
Yeah, I actually ran a CE course for therapists, mental health professionals, and it was on using social media and digital media in particular. And I had intended to spend just a couple minutes talking about, you know, what it's like to be a clinician and have a Facebook account and things you should be aware of. And that just spiraled out of control. There were so many questions. And, you know, as you dig in, it just gets deeper and deeper and deeper. So, yeah, absolutely. It's, again, it's great to have the ability to fine tune your settings, but there needs to be some kind of guidance.
And I've
up front.
I've given that same workshop. And I tried to, once I got to explaining how what I described as one-way or two-way relationships online. So like Twitter, if you're not private, everybody can see what you're posting. But in Facebook, it has to be two-way unless – and I mean – and that's way more confusing now than the last time I gave that talk. But just the idea that people are posting things and assume that no one can see it, you just don't know. Just don't know. Did I tell you that in North Carolina, everybody who is registered to vote, that information is public? Like your name and address are public information? It's crazy.
I'm trying to think if that's a – if that – no. Because I know voting records is a totally different thing. Like it's public – it's publicly accessible whether or not you voted.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know.
Yeah, because there's been some really interesting studies on turning out voter, like get out the vote operations, and then if you send pamphlets letting people know that, hey, 5 out of 6 of your neighbors have voted, then there's like social pressure for you to go vote, and it's turned out to be pretty effective. Hmm. But yeah, the whether or not you vote is a I believe is a matter of public record.
Hmm. Well, but I'm talking about specifically your name and address. So
yeah, that's a little sketchy.
Yeah, that when I was in North Carolina, that I found that I was very scared. I was the only Josue Cardona in the entire state of North Carolina. I checked, right? So if I had a client or anybody, right, who was unhappy with me or just wanted to find out more information about me, they could look me up. And I remember going to the electoral board and saying, "Hey, I'm a therapist. I don't want to have this information publicly available." It's like, well, you know, you're registered to vote. That's the way we do things here.
Because that makes sense.
I felt super safe.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And again, so, I mean, that's a great example of difficulty with privacy that's even beyond your control. I mean, if you're registered to vote, your information is publicly available. And that's kind of scary. That's not even tech. That's just dumb.
Yeah.
But I think it does speak to what we talked about earlier in that people making the rules are not the ones who are likely to have been victims or to be victims of the rules that they are making.
Yeah. And so I think we're touching what I wrote down as privacy ignorance, I guess, right? Like we don't know all these things are going on. I didn't know when I registered to vote that my information would be, available. My name and address would be available for everybody to look up easily. And so with tech, there's all these things that we just don't know, right? I mean, are your something like it's incredible how, you know, your tweets last forever, apparently, right? You can always look those things up. There are so many things on Facebook. There's so many things that are tracked on your phone. The Find My Phone is just one of those examples. So there's a lot of stuff that we're just unaware of. And like you said, they're there. I mean, sometimes those changes happen. We're just not thinking about them. Like if the developers aren't thinking about them to a certain extent.
The users.
Yeah, the users are thinking about it even less unless it's something we're dealing with at the moment, right? Like not until that moment where I'm scared for my safety or for a breach of privacy, and I am okay enough at that moment to think clearly about something like that, and then think about all the ways that my information is available to somebody who I don't want to have access to it. Do I even start thinking about that? Right. So that is a big problem, and I think that just having conversations like this and just making sure that that information is available and not hard, like don't put it in the 13 layers deep into your menu, you know, make that stuff right. Easily accessible and easily searchable. And I mean, I don't have much more to say about that other than just make it easy to find.
And that's, again, like the really nuanced and deep kind of things. And that doesn't even address kind of the broader idea of what kind of privacy can you expect in a digital space. So, for example, you can have a completely closed off Twitter where nobody can follow you and you're just following others. But as we saw with people coming over from dealing with the travel ban, having their phones confiscated and their social media examined before being allowed into the country. I mean, that to me is a huge violation of privacy and probably the Constitution, particularly the search and seizure part. But, you know, that is something that you can even do everything right. And we still somehow think that it's, or some people think that it's okay to take and to invade your privacy in that kind of way.
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer, but we are protected. And like, if somebody says, just you're not gonna give me the code, you know, like put your finger on here so we can unlock the phone. No. I don't know the specifics, but I think it leads into the next part of what I wanted to talk about, which is there is an empowerment piece to all of this, where we do have control over a lot of our information. So much so that remember last year the case with the guy who had died and Apple did not want to unlock the phone. And there's this feeling, right, that even that your information is safe, but there's a way to make it safer, right? Like don't make your passcode to unlock your phone your birthday and choose better passwords and use two-factor authentication. And all these things exist for us to protect our accounts way better than we used to be able to. And as annoying as it is to get, you know, a 14-character password requirement for something, what we're talking about, right? Like that, those are ways to actually protect your data, and there are many, many ways to do that. So if it sounded grim before, there are actually ways for you to be less vulnerable.
Yeah, my computer just requires my thumbprint before it'll turn on.
Now,
I know. I'm very excited. I have a new computer, and I'm still delighted by it.
Touch ID is very, very cool.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, there's definitely kind of two worlds here of the privacy of stuff that you have a reasonable concept of privacy. So like if you put the privacy locks on something, if you keep something, you know, restricted to friends and family, if you're posting only to a specific threat, you know, like there's a can be a reasonable expectation of privacy, I think is the term. And then there is this other thing where we just kind of throw out data where we don't really even think about what we're doing. And, you know, with all the AI coming on or being around, you know, if somebody wanted to tap my phone and see all the things that I've asked Siri, you know, that to me is, I feel like that's private information, but that's definitely something that I don't have on lockdown. I don't really have a way of doing it. That's definitely more on the developer side. And kind of the second piece we wanted to talk about, and this episode has to do with exactly that, but instead of Siri, it's with Alexa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So voice recognition is okay. But for example, it doesn't recognize voice, it can't register a user, right? So it doesn't know if it's me that's asking your phone or if it's you that's asking your phone. And that's a big step that we're kind of far from, right? In terms of what you're saying. And for example, the Google Home right now, I can link up my Google account with it, but then anybody can access my Google account when they ask it a question. And I don't want that. I want, you know, different users. It's really weird where we are, where we're advancing and then all of a sudden these questions come up and you're like, wow, wait a minute. So I can just ask it now. I don't have to type it in. I don't need that password. And with Google, the Google Home and Amazon Echo, a few things have happened. I mean, I did want to bring up that case in I think it was Arkansas back in December, where there was a murder in a home. And when the cops came in, they found that there was a Amazon Echo in the house. So they actually petitioned Amazon for the information. And this is a weird case because they essentially said, like, oh, there might be valuable information that was recorded from the device. But according to Amazon, the Echo does not record anything until you use a wake-up word, right? Although it's always listening, it doesn't record until it uses the wake-up word. So the cops assumed that it's always recording you all the time. And Amazon has never said that it does that. Again, it says that it doesn't do that. And it was a very weird situation where if the person wanted to actually use it to help them in some way, they would have had to use the wake word, right? This is one of those situations where like, okay, now that we have this type of thing, how can we use it to help me in a particular situation? The person would have had to say Alexa and then said, help me, or I'm being attacked, or I don't feel well, like anything like that for that to actually record. And again, these are conversations that we're having because now our homes are full of smart devices that are, again, technically, I'm always a little suspicious if it's always listening. Why isn't it always recording? I actually believe that it's not always recording, but I also believe that it could record at any time that it feels like it or someone else wants it to. But I assume that it's not recording all the time. And so now, like, do we have to give training on how to use Google Home and Alexa in an emergency situation? Or are they going to work automatically so that they understand that in an emergency situation, this is how they should act and react?
Well, I don't know if you remember, but again, referencing our previous Psych Tech episode where we were talking about smart AIs on our phone, I said, hey, Siri, and said, I need help. And she instantly started calling 911 and I freaked out and hung up really fast. Yep. So I think some basic things like that are, you know, I don't know if she recorded it or not, but that kind of always on function. I think of it kind of like electricity. The electricity is always on. The light might not be on, but I have to switch it. You know, once I flip the switch, but the electricity is always running. I that's kind of how I conceptualize the always on versus recording part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's funny because back then I didn't have an Echo. I didn't have a Home. I didn't have a Google Home. But the conversation is a little different now because it's not just this personal device that you have in your pocket that is fine-tuned to you. Now we're talking about devices that are in the living room with our family, with, you know, multiple people. Again, you can buy an Amazon Echo in a 6 or 7 pack and put them all over the house. Mm-hmm. And each one of those things has 7 microphones that are always listening.
You know, I can't wait for, you know, my little one to get larger and start talking using human words and saying things like, and then I killed him because he is now dead. And all the crazy, wild things that children come up with, and then have somebody come into my house and say, hey, I want to listen into your home device because there's suspicious words about blowing something up or killing somebody. And that, you know, that's going to happen. I mean, the Alexa accidentally automatically buying all those dollhouses is an example. I mean, can you imagine if maybe the TV was on in the background of this guy's house when it happened to say Alexa and turned on and either recorded what he said or recorded the audio from the television program? And
I'd never even thought of that type of thing, of like just a kid playing with his toys again, like a movie could trigger it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even have to be, you know, your kid's potty mouth. It could be all sorts of other stuff, you know?
I'm not saying that my child has a potty mouth. He just screams.
Well, he's not yet.
Well, he just screams right now, so it's all good. But yeah, just like the accidental, it's going to happen. Like accidental triggering is going to happen. And so, you know, for example, at one point I had a cat walk across my computer and it turned the webcam on and I didn't realize that the webcam was...
Oh, no.
I mean, nothing happened. And thankfully, you know,
That sounds like a Black Mirror episode.
The green light is on. And so, you know, I was in the kitchen cleaning or whatever. When I came back, I saw it was on and thought it was really weird. But, you know, so it was fine. Nothing happened. But those kinds of things are going to happen. And so I think it's really interesting, this idea that the police are requesting the data from these devices to evaluate. And I know there was a big, a similar push, I think a few years ago now, to jailbreak into somebody's iPhone because they had committed a terrorist attack and they wanted to see if they could track down other people. And
I think that's the one I was mentioning before, where the guy died. So not even after the person died, could they actually even access the information because of the way it was locked down? At least that was the conversation that was happening.
Yeah. So there's this really delicate balance between how far does the right of privacy extend? And I don't know. I'm like, on one hand, I feel, you know, if you can help put a murderer behind bars, then that's great. But I don't know if being allowed to access the cloud recordings of someone's Alexa is something like a precedent that you want to set, at least not without like a valid search warrant or some kind of subpoena for that information.
Exactly. I mean, you know, you used the Alexa dollhouse example earlier, right? So what happened was this commercial, or it was a news report where, was it a news report? I forgot what it was. Something was on the news about somebody. Yeah, that's what it was. It was a news report about a girl who had ordered a dollhouse. And then the article, the news report went off. It triggered echoes who were watching the TV, and then it went through the same process and ordered this dollhouse. Hundreds of people, you know, for hundreds right. of people, it just went ahead and created an order, and that's because Amazon's Echo is designed to make shopping easier, right? So this is where AI plays a big role. Right now, the Nest, which is a smart thermostat, they released these cameras, and they started doing this cool thing where they can recognize where there's a door automatically. You don't have to tell it. It's like, oh, there's an opening there. There's a door. So we're going to designate that a zone to be monitored more closely and regularly than other parts that we can see. And it's doing that automatically. I mean, I'm assuming it asks you like, oh, like, can you confirm? But what if it's not, right? And don't get me started on helicopter parenting, right? There's so much that, what if you do want it to be listening to your kids all the time so that they can't get away with anything?
Yeah, that's a whole nother episode.
Yeah, there's actually a Modern Family episode where the dad buys a new drone, and then he uses it to keep tabs on the kids. And why? I mean, that's where we are right now. You know, I feel that kids are more aware of these type of things. They're always trying to circumvent, right? That extra layer of helicopter parenting. But at the same time, you know, parental controls allow us to do a lot. And what does that look like when we're talking about devices like this?
Well, I mean, one thing I think is really funny that Amazon did was they named their tool Alexa. Like, that's a really common name. I mean, at least Siri is Siri, and Cortana, like, you're not going to get accidental triggers on those. So I find that to be a really weird decision on their part.
So actually, Amazon is the one who's done it the best out of all of them, because they are the only ones that allow you to use different wake-up words.
Okay, that's cool.
They have three different words now. You can use Alexa, you can say Echo, or you can say computer.
But the thing is, those are common words anyway.
Like, I mean, they are.
It reminds me of not my current dog, not Ellie, but the dog I had before her, Jake. He had an insane vocabulary. You know, you couldn't even say the word walk around him without him going ballistic. And not in the cheesy walkies kind of way, but just even, hey, I'm going to go walk to the mailbox. Boom, he'd be right there. The word walk, the word mailbox, things that you would just normally say. So we had to change it up to say perambulate instead of walk. You know, letter machine to go to the mailbox. So these kinds of things, like, we consciously had to change it because otherwise we'd wake our dog. And so the idea of even having alternate words seems silly to me, because these are common words. Like, Siri is not a word. It's a made up word. Cortana is a made up word based on a video game character. I think that's kind of silly on their part and will lead to more problems down the line. But, you know, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, but also, like, Siri and Cortana are now real things, and they're words that we're using. And if anybody's listening to this on a speaker, we just triggered all sorts of devices.
I'm so sorry.
I made sure to trigger your Echo however you have it set up, because I said all three words.
Yep. Or was really funny is my Xbox, obviously it's quote unquote always on and listens. And sometimes when the baby's screaming, it lights up and it said, "I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said." I'm like, "Me either, Xbox. I don't know what he's saying either."
Well, the last thing I want to touch on is that as vulnerable as we can feel with the technology, technology is also can also be very helpful. So I do believe in the empowering part. There's all sorts of stuff that we can do, and if you start if you feel like you may be in an unsafe situation, technology can help you in different ways. And I was thinking of the idea, we did an episode, man, a long time ago about life logging and having these cameras that are constantly, you know, recording. We have, again, these devices that are always listening, that if you trigger them, they can listen, they can call for help. We do have, remember the old life alert? Like that,
help, I've fallen and I can't get up.
Yeah, which was just like a little remote that you had on a chain and you would press the button and it would essentially just use your phone to call someone and then that person would talk to you. And if you didn't respond, they would send somebody. You know, we have that, the most advanced version, you know, we've advanced a lot in 20 or 30 years, and there are ways to use technology also to keep us safe. And I'm glad to see that Google is, you know, and other companies too, I'm sure, but that this, you know, was getting some coverage where we're looking at ways that, again, it's twofold. It's not only how to protect yourself better, but how to also use this technology to keep yourself safer.
I just want to reiterate that to use your cyber smarts. You know, there's street smarts, there's book smarts, and now there's cyber smarts. You know, I have two-step authentication on all of my devices. And although it annoys me sometimes when I have three different email accounts and I have to, you know, sign into them on, and sometimes it can get frustrating, but it's really important. Same thing with Twitter, same thing with Facebook, you know, just trying to be smart. I don't think anybody needs to be an expert because technology is changing so fast and it's hard to keep up. But even just kind of doing the basics, it's almost the equivalent of, you know, when you lock your door when you leave your house and you lock your car when you go to the grocery store. And, you know, there are some basic precautions that you take, and you obviously can't control everything. But, you know, by doing the basics, you greatly reduce your vulnerability. So I think that's a really good thing to keep in mind going forward. And like you mentioned, for those people who are in situations or those who are vulnerable, you know, finding ways to support them, I think, is really important. I don't think it's necessarily a priority because people who are, again, making these kinds of things likely haven't experienced that kind of the kind of stuff in their lives. And so they're not likely to consider it when designing. But the idea of designing intelligently with like helping people, I think, is a really important thing as we go forward and in the tech, whether help means making shopping easier or, I mean, yeah, just helping people to not get trapped in abusive relationships would be awesome.
I've thought a lot about the police shootings last year, right, where people were recording them.
Yes.
Not only like going live immediately and making sure that stuff is available, making sure that there's a record. That's what a lot of these devices are allowing us to do easier and easier. You know, it's something to keep in mind. It's something that to just train on, right? It may not be you. You may be trying to save someone else. And we have the technology to be able to help each other in that way.
Yeah, the word you used throughout most of the episode was empowered. And so I do hope that technology continues to empower people just in general, for it to continue to be a larger good than it is negative.
Agreed. And that's it for us today on PsychTech. For more PsychTech, visit psychtechpodcast.com. I am at Josue A. Cardona on Twitter. Kelly is Kelly N. Dunlap on Twitter. We are at PsychTechCast on Twitter. Let us know what you thought of this episode. Let us know if you have any questions about any of this stuff, because this is what we think about all the time. We're not legal experts, but at least we could give a few tips.
And the Fourth Amendment is, you know, the not allowing illegal search and seizure. So just a little tidbit there. Oh, and come join our Facebook group, because we're really cool. Geek Therapy Facebook group. We're awesome.
Yep. And I'll put links to everything that we talked about in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you in 2 weeks.
Bye, everybody.